Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Each month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Jürgen Matthäus to the show. Jürgen is the Director of Applied Research at the Jack, Joseph, and Morton Mandel Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and the author or editor of several volumes about the Holocaust. Today, we'll be talking about his book, War, Pacification, and Mass Murder, 1939, the Einsatzgruppen in Poland, which Jürgen edited with Jochen Böhler and Klaus Michael Mollmann. The book is part of a series of books published by the museum entitled Documenting Life and Destruction, Holocaust Sources in Context. Like the other books in the series, this book includes a wide variety of carefully chosen documents. But rather than simply providing a paragraph of introduction to go along with the documents, Jürgen and his colleagues include extensive sections of prose, putting the documents into context, and crafting a broader narrative from them. It's a wonderful book, which sheds light on an important and under-examined moment in the evolution of German actions and policies. I'm thrilled to talking with him about it. And so with that, Jürgen, thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start by just giving you a chance to tell us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the history of the Holocaust.
Well, I'm an historian. I'm German. I'm born in Germany. And I basically owe my place where I am right now to three people. One is Hans Mommsen, who was my professor at Ruhr University in Bochum. I studied with him there. The second person is Konrad Klee, the professor of German studies in Australia, near Australia, who supported very much my being there in Australia during my PhD, and then also was the chief historian at the War Crimes Investigation Unit, which I was involved in for some time. And the third person is Raoul Hilberg, who is the doyen of Holocaust studies, as many of your listeners might know, who fostered and really pushed the idea of research and publications at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum early on in the museum's history.
Many of the people who think of the museum, and I think probably almost everybody in the United States at least knows about it, thinks of the museum in terms of the exhibit, but it actually spends a great deal of time and attention and resources supporting research into and teaching about the Holocaust. Can you talk a little bit about what that element of the museum's mission is and how the Mandel Center supports it?
Well, as you said, it's absolutely true that most of the audience consists of the people who come through the building and spend a lot of time in the permanent exhibition. However, there is a range of things the museum is doing physically in the building and then, of course, in other ways, publishing on the web and in print. Where I am at the Jack, Joseph, and Morton Mandel Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies within the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, we really deal with in-house research and publication projects. So this is really geared towards a more specific and, if you like, a little narrower audience than the audience the museum tries to attract through its exhibition. So we are trying to mine the museum's archives, which are really extensive. For anyone who has been here, I think will be quite impressed with the number of documents that we have here on site, which have been gathered over many years in more than 40 countries. It's part of the museum's mission on rescuing the evidence. So this is really the basis for our project on documenting life and destruction that you briefly described in your setup piece. And we are really privileged to be here, the small group of scholars who work on this project, to mine this material and to have it right there at our fingertips. Increasingly, however, a lot of that material that's here in the archive can be accessed also online. So this is going in conjunction with digitization that many other institutions are doing too.
This is maybe an appropriate time, Jürgen, to give your disclaimer.
Yes, well, I have to say that what I say are my opinions and not the opinions of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
So what is this series about? How did you all decide to work on this series, and what are your hopes for it?
Well, it's really an outgrowth of the amount of stuff, let's put it that way, that the museum has collected. Yeah, it comes in multiple formats. So it's not only documents, as we classically would understand them, written documentation from the Nazi era. There's a lot of material that we have here by way of microfilm copies. It comes from a range of archives, again, from many, many countries. The project started basically in the time of the emergence of the museum, with the Soviet Union when it was starting to disintegrate, and from there has really spread into, well, most of the countries on the globe, really, as far as they have any archival set of documentation that might be relevant to the museum. So there was a massive collecting effort underway, and it still is. So the colleagues who are working on that are still very active in many countries. It's here, it's available to researchers and many of our fellows. One of the programs the museum is doing here, and the center specifically, is geared toward attracting fellows. We have a competitive fellowship program, mm-hmm. and these people, of course, come here, spend several months here, do their project based often on the archival material here, and then they go back, write a book, and that's it. So the idea in setting up this unit that I'm directing is really to produce something that these individual scholars might not be able to do, because it requires a long duration to get it done. It requires specific resources and a lot of resources, especially money in some respect, because it takes so long. And also use the opportunity that we have the material here, and constantly as we sit here, we are so close to documentation. I should mention that in addition to documenting life and destruction, the other large-scale project that we are doing here at our little unit of applied scholars is the Encyclopedia of Camps and Ghettos, which is a massive undertaking, has been going on for more than 15 years. So far has produced two volumes, one on, if you like, the standard classical concentration camps, and the other ones on ghettos. There are six more volumes to come. It's a massive undertaking, and we're still at it. So between this and the other project, this is really where we spend our time.
I was going to say, it's a staggering amount of research you all do. And this is maybe one of the things I was struck by in kind of reading the book we're going to talk about today, is the fact that you're also working in partnerships with other institutions across the globe.
Right. That's one of the ideas. So we're not sitting here in a bubble, if you like, and mulling over documents. This is really meant to be done in conjunction with scholars in this country, and across the globe. We have contacts that are quite intensive to colleagues here in the U.S. and elsewhere. But also it comes back to the notion and to your question that you asked earlier, what the audience is. And clearly, we are primarily trying to reach students of the Holocaust, and that could be those who teach it and those who study it at colleges. We are not aiming primarily at high school students, so that's another kind of branch, if you like, of the museum that deals with that. But clearly we are trying to attract an interested audience that is interested in the Holocaust in general and in its many topics many of which have not been researched properly and who are willing to encounter new material, because what we do is really trying to showcase the documents while we offer contextual analysis. Focus is on documentation.
Well, and my little bit of anecdotal evidence suggests that this, or would suggest that this series succeeds, right? I've used this in used various volumes in the series in my classes, and students are always very interested in them and read them, which seems normal, but in, as you probably know, with university students, is not actually always done. But here they do it, which is a good sign.
Indeed, it is, and of course we're happy whenever that happens. Within our series on documenting life and destruction, we have a subset of Jewish responses to persecution from 1933 to 1946, five volumes, and altogether hundreds and hundreds of documents. Now that, of course, is a large chunk of stuff, and it's really a lot to ask for college students to read all that, and clearly it won't happen. But there is a corpus of material that this publication presents, as do others, of course, but this one particularly on that subject Jewish responses that is available and that indeed teachers in the classroom are using in extract, and of course they're trying to focus on what they're interesting while they're teaching on their specific topics. But that's the kind of outreach that we want to have. So it really is the teaching folks, the students and their teachers.
So let's then talk about this book in particular. And why did you decide to include this book in the series?
Well, we thought this is a topic that isn't really all that much on people's radar. We seems to be almost commonplace to say that, yes, the Holocaust, properly understood, started with the war. However, the Polish campaign is not really integrated into that to a large degree. It is seen often as still a fairly standard military campaign. Mm-hmm. And if atrocity happened, they were part of that campaign and aren't really talked about much. So we thought we want to correct this presupposition that's out there. And also, of course, by focusing on a specific unit or set of units, the security police and the SD, that created those reports, other documents that we feature in that volume. We know, and probably the audience knows, that the security police and SD, which was commanded over by Reinhard Heydrich, turned out then to be the core group for the implementation of the Holocaust. So here we have an early incident or set of incidents and a campaign that looks like the prelude to the Holocaust. Now, when you read the book, you see that this is not quite the argument that we're making, and perhaps that's something we talk about in the next question.
Yeah, and just as a side note to listeners, if you haven't been listening for a while, I interviewed Robert Gerwarth about his biography of Heydrich a year or two ago, and if you're interested in him, you can find that podcast on the website. But let's start. How did German leadership and the people involved in planning for the war, what did they anticipate the war against Poland to be like?
Well, I think if you focus on the leadership from Hitler downward, and including the military elite, there was the understanding that Poland is an illegitimate state, that this is an aberration that came about, as many other things, as a result of World War I. Now, for the traditional elites in Germany, World War I was a disaster, and of course for the larger population too, but particularly for these conservative elites, the nationalist circles, the idea that there was a state formed after World War I that incorporated former German territory was just outrageous, and it had to disappear from the map. But this is an idea that is really shared among top Nazis and the conservative military leadership.
And so, along with the German military, and as you suggest, these units called Einsatzgruppen enter Poland in the quite quickly after the invasion starts. What are these Einsatzgruppen?
Right. So, in addition to the fighting corps, which of course the Wehrmacht, the German military, which is the backbone and really the core of military aggression, moving forward, fighting the enemy. There was an understanding fairly early on in the planning for this campaign and subsequent ones that it was not enough to just take out the enemy by way of defeating Polish army, but you had to do a second thing, and that is to secure the area for long-term domination. Securing and pacifying that area required the use of non-military entities. And there was an agreement between the military leadership and the SS, headed by Heinrich Himmler, of course, to help the military out by way of providing police units, mobile units, that would follow the advancing German military very quickly and would perform key functions in squashing anything that looked like resistance. So the key focus of these units, which are highly mobile, very small, is to identify potential enemies and then to fight them and take them out. That could mean a number of things. Arrests, and then, of course, execution.
Where did they get this assumption that pacification would be necessary?
Well, this was one of the kind of the standing beliefs in that specific branch of the Nazi apparatus. We have to see this in the context of Himmler's realm of influence. This is, of course, a unit that at its core consists of very committed Nazis, many of whom have been early on party members. If we look at the membership of the Einsatzgruppen, there's a total in Poland of about 2,700. So compared to the Wehrmacht, very small. Mm-hmm. But in terms of their ideological commitment, this is really hardcore. Many of these people not only have PhDs in terms of the commanders of these units, but they also have a very early party membership or in kind of activism that they can point to that predates other folks joining the party who joined, for example, in 1933. So many of them have joined much earlier, and they have also a background in either fighting during the war as during World War One as veterans, or as being members of the Freikorps, so the post-World War One Civil War units that often in this border region between Germany and Poland played a crucial role in fighting, in this case, the Polish army or insurgents, if you like, in this unstable phase after World War One. So you have a highly kind of committed core there that after the Third Reich takes over in Germany, or after Hitler takes over and the Third Reich starts in 1933, many of these men are put into positions of power as members of the state police, the criminal police, the Gestapo, and they then get trained in fighting the enemy. So that's starting in 1933. They, by 1939, have a clear idea who the enemy is. It is first and foremost, of course, enemy number one, and that's the Jews. And they have been involved in anti-Jewish policies since 1933, surveillance and anti-Jewish measures. And then, of course, it's anyone who is ethnically or racially not acceptable. And if we're looking across the border, that would be the great bulk of the Polish population, with the exception, at least that's in the mind of the Nazis at the time, the exception of the ethnic Germans. So those people who have a German heritage, live in Poland, and are seen as member of the German folk proper.
So, and as these people are preparing, both in the military and in the Einsatzgruppen, are preparing to go into Poland in late August, how detailed are their instructions?
The instructions were not really all that detailed. So they were rather vague. If we look at these documents, many of which have survived, we don't find clear orders there. We find a kind of a range of broad topics that were to be covered. But when it comes to executions, for example, who is to be executed, you find very little, if anything, at all. And that is not so surprising if we keep in mind how, again, Himmler's apparatus functioned. This is not so much a traditional military machine. Of course, there was kind of the ideal by Himmler to make it look like the military, and they all felt like soldiers, that's for sure. But they were also trained to take initiative on their own, not to wait until they get orders from the top and then to merely follow orders. They were there because especially the officers were appointed because they were expected to have a thorough understanding of the ultimate goal. And based on that understanding, you use all opportunities that you have that open up along the way to make this goal come true. So that means that you are the expert on the ground. The unit commander knows best what to do. And within these general guidelines, which again are often quite vague, it is left to the unit commander and his men to execute policy towards a commonly understood goal. And that's a phenomenon that starts in that campaign in 1939, and then we can perceive that in a much more radicalized fashion once the war starts against the Soviet Union in 1941, which is also a key, that is really the key aspect of Einsatzgruppen history in the Second World War, because there is a massive killing wave that starts immediately after the Einsatzgruppen get deployed in the Soviet Union in 1941. A little bit different in Poland, also with a different target group.
So what do they find in the initial days of the campaign, and how do they respond?
Well, they find basically what they're looking for. So you can see a mindset that is pretty much set, that doesn't allow for much kind of taking in new impressions. They are looking for partisans, if you want to use that word. That's not the one used at the time. But they're looking for anyone who could pose any kind of resistance. And the German military has a similar obsession. So while the military is very nervous and many units start executing Polish civilians, the Einsatzgruppen do the same. And so there is a joint obsession with security. And anyone who looks askance and might pose a potential danger is on the list. The second, and this is really pretty unique for the Einsatzgruppen, is their focus on the Polish elite. They have an understanding as to who those are, clearly Polish nationalists. In fact, there is also a list of suspects that the Einsatzgruppen as a police unit was supposed to arrest. It wasn't always very accurate. It was often outdated. But anyway, it indicates a pre-identification of a set of enemies. And Polish elites, so members of the clergy, intellectuals, politicians, most of them non-Jews, were on that list. And then, of course, on top of that, you have the traditional enemy number one, the Jews.
Are they on that list precisely because they are imagined to be leaders of some kind of resistance, or are they on that list because they're believed to be... And I know this is that one melds into the other, but because they will interfere with German plans for what they're going to do with Poland after the campaign is won.
Well, there's a short-term element of that and a long-term. The short-term is, of course, you have to immediately squash any kind of resistance to make sure that the area is really conquered. And then to start your administration, which is kind of the medium range. So you have to be trying to set up an administrative apparatus. Military starts, but then the understanding is that as part of Hitler's plan to take over the East and provide living space in the East, this is all going to be German-dominated, if not annexed to the Reich. And that's exactly what happens, of course. After the end of the Polish campaign, the Eastern chunk gets taken over by the Soviets, who are at that time an ally of Hitler, and join the fighting on the 17th of September, so basically 2.5 weeks after the Germans have started invading Poland. And the western parts of Poland get integrated, annexed to the Reich, while there is a chunk of Poland left that becomes the Generalgouvernement, which is under a special administration under Hans Frank, the former lawyer to Hitler, and is also where we... If we look at ghetto images and things like that, this is what we associate with Poland at the time. So the Generalgouvernement is really a very prominent feature of German domination. The bottom line is, at the end of 1939, Poland doesn't exist anymore.
How much violence is there? Maybe I should ask, do they find what they're looking for precisely because they're looking for it, or is there actually significant, I guess we can call it, partisan resistance? And
well, I think it's a mix of both. You have real resistance, and there are atrocities committed against ethnic Germans, particularly in Bydgoszcz or German Bomberg, where the Germans coming in can point to atrocities being committed. And that triggers a massive wave of violence in that city and in the vicinity particularly, where several hundred are executed immediately once the Germans take over. Overall, the numbers of those killed is difficult to get at. And we have estimates. The reason is that the reports that are incoming from the units are often not there. So what we have collected in our volume is a little bit of that material. We also try to incorporate victim perceptions, so testimonies, often post-war testimonies by those who were there, who observed or were subjected to that violence. And then there is post-war judicial investigations that shed little light on this part of the history. The estimates are in the range of 10,000 civilians being killed during the fighting, another 16,000 until the end of October, so after the end of the fighting. And then for the areas annexed by Germany, the estimate of those poles, Jews and non-Jews, is at 60,000 until the end of 1939. But there is a chunk, it's kind of a gray zone there. Many of the figures pertaining to Eastern Europe are murky and are still worked on. But that's kind of, I think, a realistic estimate.
You have this initial wave of, or perhaps not initial wave, but this initial response of the German soldiers to the perceived resistance, whether it actually existed or not. How does the leadership in Berlin and in the Wehrmacht respond to the executions?
Well, first, they are the ones who are really interested in being as harsh as possible. So they set the stage with their rather vague guidelines, but also by the propaganda that comes from Berlin, by speeches from Hitler and so on. In the inner circle, for example, vis-a-vis army leaders, Hitler is very outspoken about the fact that Poland is doomed to cease to exist. There's no future for it, and this all will be German-dominated territory. So there is a large kind of, not only buy-in, but clearly an expectation on the part of the regime that these measures have to be taken. So there is an interaction, though, and I think your question is points at that. There's an interaction going on between the reports coming in from the field and the centers in Berlin. It's not quite clear, of course, at the very beginning of the campaign how this is all going to play out, from the military fate of the act, of what's going on there, to then the long-term aspect of it. But once there is a system that becomes established, the leadership in Berlin has no problems whatsoever with atrocities being committed, to the point that Hitler actively takes steps to hinder the Wehrmacht from investigating SS and police people who have overstepped the line in the eyes of the military by being too brutal, by having executed too many civilians. This is a phenomenon that is somewhat restricted to the Polish campaign, the German military complaining about excessive violence. This doesn't happen then anymore in the Soviet campaign. So the military leadership also then expects the SS and police to fulfill a certain function, mostly in a way to do the dirty work for them. So the military sees itself as a fighting force, and we leave the rest then to Himmler's men, and we are not really all that interested in how they do what they do as long as the pacification goal is attained.
I was really struck. In some of the documents you reproduce that outline and I'm not sure govern is the right word, but lay out the relationship between the Wehrmacht and the Einsatzgruppen about how ordinary they sound, about how bureaucratic and administrative they are. The part that sticks in my mind is this. I think it's in the agreement before the campaign actually starts, where this procedure laid out for how arrests would be conducted, and you've got two carbon copies of arrest reports, and this carbon copy goes, you know, it's not what I think people expect to read when they read documents about death and destruction.
Right. Well, this is not unstructured violence. This is structured along the lines of a military campaign and with the background of the experience within particularly Himmler's apparatus. So the policemen who are now in a quasi-military function perform as policemen. The war environment, of course, makes it possible for them to adopt much more radical means than the means they had at their disposal in Germany. Very, very few. In fact, I think it's only two of the Einsatzgruppen leaders were involved in direct physical violence, murder, before the start of the war. But the war starts, this changes very, very quickly, and then they all become involved.
So what do the documents say about how the people in the Einsatzgruppen, the ordinary rank and file, how do they respond to this? Is it hard for them to behave this way?
There are some, of course, who think they're doing the right thing. Some are eager to do what they're asked to do. And some would be reluctant because that's probably not what they expected, and some might not like it at all. It is very, very difficult ex post to get an idea as to the motivation at the time, the mindset of the men at the time. I think that's probably one of the hardest things for, well, I don't know, perhaps even genocide scholars in general, just beyond the Holocaust, to figure out why these perpetrators did what they did, and I think that's where the scholarship is really grappling. Historians have a limited tool set there at their disposal, because we are stuck with the sources that we have. If the sources aren't there, we have very little to say, and we basically are left with speculation. But I think we can assume, based on also other scenarios and what then happens later, that there is an active core of enthusiastic killers that drive that. Sometimes from the leadership, but sometimes it's also subordinate people who take massive initiative, are not negatively sanctioned by their commanders, and thus not only get away with it, but are seen as positive role models. And that forms a kind of a command climate and a group cohesion that lends itself to getting rid of any inhibitions people might have, and of course making new, more radical measures possible the next time over. I have a document here that might be interesting as a case in point. And that's a little, I mean, I have to explain what it is. It's a little odd because it's an SS investigation done in late 1939. And so one wouldn't really expect the SS investigating excessive violence, right, among its own members. The reason or the background here is that the commander who is charged is suspected of base motives and also corruption. So there is an investigation that takes place, and there is a criminal policeman who asks one of the members of that unit as to what had happened in this particular incident and why he had given a prior statement where he had referred to criminal habits being formed. And if it's okay, I'll just read that passage here from that SS member, what is meant by that and what he had meant by this prior statement. So here's a quote. By the term criminal habits, I meant partly the shootings, but partly also other unwarranted brutality. Based on my actions in Einsatzkommando 3 of Einsatzgruppe 1, I have come to the conclusion that a human life has absolutely no value there. In the beginning, several shootings were undertaken without obtaining a verdict from the military courts. Later, the persons in question were brought before the military court, which sentenced them to death. Personally, however, I was especially disgusted by the way these executions were carried out. All those sentenced to death were executed by being shot in the back of the neck with a pistol. The condemned had to step up to the edge of a pit that had been dug beforehand, and then they were killed with a shot to the back of the neck. There's a question then by the interrogator. Did it happen that those sentenced were not dead yet after the first shot? And the answer is, I quote, yes. In these cases, further shots were fired. The members of the execution squad were just not trained for these tasks. In my opinion, it would have been quite possible to hand the people over either to the Wehrmacht or to the border police for the carrying out of the death sentence. I think these people, so the members of the execution squad, should at least have been shown how to perform executions so that they would not just fire haphazardly into the back of the neck without causing, as already mentioned, immediate death. I attended one execution where I shot one of the condemned men myself. At first I stood by, and after the shots had been fired and the condemned man had fallen into the pit, I noticed that one person had not been hit at all, but had fallen apparently out of fear into the pit. I then killed that person from above, specifically with a shot to the back of the head, unquote. So one might wonder why this entire investigation and what's behind it. Now, the reason is that within the SS, it was perfectly fine to kill Jews, other suspects, because they were seen as enemies of the Reich. If, however, these actions were perceived on the basis of what was seen as base motives, greed, brutality, this was seen as endangering the fabric of the units. The other men exposed to this violence would be in danger of becoming brutalized, and that was clearly something that the SS leadership, Himmler personally, wanted to avoid.
How fascinating. I'm also struck, there's a document earlier in the book, and I only see this reference once, but a gender reference, and this is a post-war interrogation of a member of one of the Einsatz commandos, where he says that his commander or superior officer, I'm skimming through this, says, in this action, quote, anyone can prove he's a real man, unquote. That's kind of an isolated comment about gender. Does that reappear in other sources that maybe didn't end up in the book? Or
there is a little bit of that, but you would, I mean, again, this is very, very difficult to find, and it's also very difficult to read, because why would that person say that? Why would it be entered into the record? These records are often not verbatim, but then written down by the interrogator. So again, for historians, the source criticism element is really quite a tough nut to crack. I would not want to generalize there, but I think this is clearly what you just quoted is clearly an important aspect, that there is the inner group and the workings of the inner group. The fact that I think it comes back to what Christopher Browning has explained in his Ordinary Man, the situational aspects and the in-group mechanisms within these units that are very important to understand why these men performed what they did while before and after they were perfectly, well, ordinary.
Yeah, one of the other places that I found really striking in the book is the photos that you reproduce. And I should parenthetically compliment you and compliment the publishers on the fact that the publishers have apparently established a website where you can access the pictures in a larger and more detailed fashion. I think that's wonderful. But the photos are really startling. What do you make of the fact that German soldiers are taking pictures of what they're doing?
Well, I think this was probably for many of them the first time they left the country. There was a war tourism of sorts, and many soldiers had access to cheap photographic cameras. And that was something that is not really all that uncommon. So photographs were made all the time. Sometimes, although it was prohibited, mass executions were not to be photographed. Still, it happened, and there is quite a number of sources that are left that document these atrocities. There's one sequence, it might be the one that you refer to, where we reproduce album pages. Mm-hmm. Photographs that are integrated into a narrative that is created by the officer or the member of the Einsatzgruppe. And there you can see not only the isolated image, which we can read one way or another, but the storyline that this Einsatzgruppe member wants us to be aware of. Now, obviously, this might have been primarily for his own consumption to kind of show around within family and fellow unit members. But it indicates as to the kind of experience they were having and how they saw this as a really a memorable piece of their own life, and something that was almost like an exotic attraction, or like a visit to, I don't know, to Paris, where you would make photographs and you wanted to record that.
What about the victims in terms of their role in Polish society? How are women and men treated how did the Germans treat women and men differently, if at all?
They did, and that I think comes back to the gender perception prevailing not only generally at the time, but particularly among the Nazi elites, where women were not seen as being dangerous in that sense when it comes to political activities. So the target group of violence is mostly male. There are women, however, who get targeted either because of their political background or because they were active in the Catholic Church, often based on allegations that were fabricated or false. Generally, however, as far as we know, the vast majority of the victims executed, and I mentioned the number 60,000 until the end of 1939, were male, and they were predominantly non-Jewish, again, members of the elite.
So then, is there a way in which Jews as target or as victims play a different role, either on the ground or in German thinking, than the broader categories of victims and threats the Germans perceived?
They do. They clearly do. And I think that has also to do with the overall image of the Jews, so this kind of very strange collective singular that anti-Semites often use. The Eastern Jews, or those Jews beyond the German border towards the east, are seen as being particularly characteristic of their race and particularly dangerous, because there are so many of them, and they have a lifestyle that is so different from not only what German culture represents, but also what the Polish state and nation represents. So I think it's fair to say that the German occupiers saw Jews in Poland as something that on the one end was characteristic for their Polish experience, on the other hand disconnected from the threat that Poland posed as a political entity, as a military entity. And so there is an overlap in terms of elites, obviously, but the classical stereotype that comes to mind, the Jews dressed in their garb and living in certain quarters of either big cities or in small towns in the Städte, that makes them a specific and identifiable target group, one that you would not find at that time in the Reich in Germany proper, and thus would trigger this anti-Semitism that had been inbred into the SS and police, and so they become almost immediately victims of this aggression that is triggered by them looking like the standard image that Nazi propaganda projects.
So once the actual military campaign is done, what happens to these Einsatzgruppen and the people in them? And does that change in function change their treatment of the people in Poland at all?
Well, once the war has come to an end, the units become stationary. So many of these men get integrated into the police posts that are created all over the either annexed parts of Poland or in the Generalgouvernement, which is this kind of fiefdom under Hans Frank. So you have also other people coming in. There is a fluctuation, as always is, among Himmler's apparatus, where people would never spend much time in one location but get exchanged. So that's also the same model that then is implemented later on in all occupied territories, where you have first mobile units, particularly in the Soviet Union, and then many unit members become members of the stationary unit. The functions primarily remain the same. The intensity can differ, because obviously now these policemen have more time. They can assume that they can go about their business more systematically, and thus they create the infrastructure for that. Informers, auxiliary policemen, which is very important in Poland. So you have ethnic Germans who are drafted into the services of the SS and police already during the campaign. And other things that you would do to create, if you like, a normal police function, which really spread and incorporates the entire spectrum of police work in any country, with the added factor of violence against those who seem to threaten the pacification goal.
So you referred to this broader issue of interpretation, and so let's return to that. We're kind of coming to the close of our time. How do you understand this campaign and the broader arc of German policy toward Jews and other people in the East?
Well, I think it is an important precedent, probably less in terms of the victim group, because, again, we have to keep in mind that the majority of victims are non-Jewish. But precedent insofar as you have the first deployment of a core group of committed Nazis and then also people who become killers in the process. The Einsatzgruppen then get redeployed in other campaigns, and particularly during the Operation Barbarossa, so the German attack on the Soviet Union starting in June 1941, the Einsatzgruppen are the ones that really push the envelope and pass the threshold from persecution to systematic annihilation. If we see that in the context, we see this as an important precedent. There's also an element of personal continuity. Many of the members of the Einsatzgruppen deployed in Poland in 1939 also are members of the Einsatzgruppen in 1941, or then even until the end of the war, there was even an Einsatzgruppe at the Einsatzkommandos at the battles of the Bulge towards the very end of the war.
So we've taken up a lot of your time. For people who are interested in going further, what would you recommend that they read or they watch?
Well, there's an awful lot of documentary material that we try to point to by way of our Documenting Life and Destruction series. Now, this book that we just discussed is very much focused on perpetrator documents and also represents the perpetrator perspective. There is, however, a lot of material, many of which untapped, generated by victims, particularly, of course, here at the Holocaust Museum, generated by Jews. Our series on Jewish responses to persecution tries to reflect that material, but there is so much more, and I would really want to encourage people to look at the sources, look at the contextualization that's offered. We are starting on a digital project that eventually will become available through college teachers, students too, that teaches these documents online. And, of course, you can do so much more in other formats than print. As you just said, photographs are difficult to print sometimes. You need to think about other options, and that's where we're heading at. So that would be my recommendation, really, to go to the sources. And interest is often triggered, of course, by secondary studies, articles, and so on. That's great. But eventually, I think, people would find it very rewarding to look at the material that the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has, and other institutions do. There's an awful lot.
Yeah, I would endorse that, and as I've said before about other books in previous interviews, I encourage all of y'all who are listening to go out and get this book. We've kind of covered the high points, and we've kind of tried to put the documents in context, but it's reading the documents itself that really brings you to a kind of so both a deeper awareness of the events that we're discussing, but also kind of asks you or forces you to come to grips with what you're reading in a way that you're not going to get just with a broader kind of narrative description. So go out and buy the book or get the book from the library. It's a wonderful book. And we've taken a lot of your time. As I said, you're going to still very much appreciate it. What are you working on now?
Well, as part of our series, we're currently working on the final touches of the diary of Alfred Rosenberg with one of the leading Nazis, and the close associate to Hitler. The book will come out in German in April and in English in the fall. The series will continue, and so there's a lot that still is here in the archive and elsewhere that we can draw on.
Well, I hope when that comes out and as future volumes come out, you'll be willing to come back on the show and talk about it.
Oh, definitely. My pleasure.
Excellent. Well, as I said before, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to reading the stuff you do in the future.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Jürgen Matthäus about the book War, Pacification, and Mass Murder, 1939, The Einsatzgruppen in Poland. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll talk with Scott Strauss about his new book, Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.